Hi, this is Smriti Kirvanandan, your host for Health Forward Podcast. One of the most important things you can do for yourself is to take care of your health. Your road to discovering an all-inclusive, empathetic, and innovative healthcare ecosystem starts right now. A quote by Charles Darwin. The love for all living creatures is the most noble attribute of man. Whole and minimally processed plant-based foods are not only the healthiest and most sustainable foods around, they are also some of the most affordable. In fact, going plant-based can cut grocery bills by $750 a year per person, according to the Journal of Hunger and Environmental Nutrition. In this episode, I'm in conversation with James Wilkes, a plant-based activist, a UFC champion, and an English film producer of the most famous documentary, The Game Changers, that is presented by James Cameron, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jackie Chan, Lewis Hamilton, Novak Djokovic, and Chris Paul. James, welcome to Health Forward. Such a pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
So James, you're a winner of The Ultimate Fighter, a plant-based advocate, and the creator of the famous Game Changers documentary, which I've loved, and a lot of people's lives have been changed. And I understand your journey started from an injury leading to the discovery of Roman gladiators being meat-free. Let's unravel this one for the audience.
Yeah, so I was training with a future heavyweight champion, Fabrizio Verdum, with about 70 pounds of muscle on me. And we were sparring pretty hard. I landed some sweat, tore ligaments in both of my knees. And I thought, well, you know, now I can't train for at least 6 months. What can I do with my time that's going to be productive? So I decided to really look into nutrition for optimal recovery. So I looked at the peer-reviewed science and read journals and so forth. And I thought, you know, I started sort of realizing what I'd led to believe and wasn't necessarily true. And one of the turning points, as you mentioned, was I came across a study about the Roman gladiators. They archaeologists unearthed over 5,000 gladiator bones in Ephesus, Turkey. They did a strontium calcium and a radioisotope analysis, and they can tell that the gladiators were eating almost exclusively plants. And I thought, well, that can't be true because you need meat for muscle and dairy for bones. So that wasn't enough to convince me, but that sort of was an inciting incident that got me really wanting to dig deeper and look at the myths and see if this was really true. Because I honestly couldn't believe it. I wouldn't have eaten a single meal really without animal products before, both as an athlete and as a man. I felt for some reason that I needed it. Turns out that was all, a myth. And that, you know, protein originates in plants. Animals are just the middleman, and you can cut that middleman out and go straight to the source and get all the protein you need and all the other nutrients on a plant-based diet. So that's sort of what led into making this documentary. I interviewed the head of nutrition at Harvard, the head of anthropology at Harvard, the president of the American College of Cardiology, the lead delegate for urology for the American Medical Association, and these other experts in nutrition and archaeology, and also interviewed a number of athletes. And that's what became The Game Changers, which became, by conservative estimates, the most viewed documentary of all time. We had over 1.5 billion media impressions, including 40,000 organic articles written about the film. And interest in plant-based eating more than tripled worldwide, according to metrics on Google Trends, within a few weeks of the film's release. So, yeah, it was an interesting sort of journey for me, searching for the truth in nutrition, and obviously it had a huge impact.
Fantastic. That's amazing. So congratulations. You made an interesting point, and I'm going to catch on that. And you said, as a man, not eating meat, it was interesting to you. Do you think for men, it's kind of a stigma nowadays, maybe previously, if they were not eating meat?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It seems more feminine. I think that was the perception. I think there's a number of reasons for that. One, there's sort of this notion of man the hunter. In fact, we interviewed the archaeologist that set that conference up in 1967, which was called Man the Hunter. And the main finding of the conference was that man the hunter was a misnomer, and that actually it would really be man the gatherer, scavenger, hunter in that order. So gathering primarily, you know, ancestors were getting most of the calories from gathering foods, plant foods, and then they would be scavenging, so there'd be leftover meat, you know, from other animals' kills. And then, you know, there was certainly some hunting. And as you moved away from the equator, you required that. But I think, so that's part of it, is man the hunter sort of myth and the way that we've sort of framed that. It was also largely a male, archaeologists in the 70s were, you know, nearly all male, right? And so there was this male slant of like man the hunter, the provider of foods. And I even think to some extent, you know, the modern barbecue is really a display of hey, you can come over and look at all the, you know, the animal products I've got, which is sort of a symbol of wealth in some ways. Mm-hmm. And you can come all eat for free, you know, just mm-hmm. come eat the kale that I've got, even though they just went to the supermarket and bought it. And then also, you know, from a compassion perspective, a lot of behavioral psychology research we did, compassion is synonymous with femininity. So if you start caring about the animals or the planet or even your health, a lot of men are insecure about their masculinity. So if they feel a little bit compassionate, they might feel a little bit female. So they don't want to do anything that's compassionate either for themselves sometimes or for the environment or the animals. So that's another thing where I think this sort of real men eat meat myth sort of stems from, if you will.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I often tell my friends and family, you are what you eat. I mean, what you eat is also how you treat yourself. So it's very similar to what you just said. So mm-hmm. in this movie, you work with some incredible producers. My favorite, not to be biased, Jackie Chan, James Cameron, Arnold, Lewis Hamilton, Chris Paul, all of them amazing. What did you learn from them in terms of dedication, art, ideas? Because they're just coming from this incredible background.
Yeah, well, I think out of all of those, I mean, everyone was extremely helpful and informative in their own way. But James Cameron in particular, in terms of story making and so forth, I mean, Jim Cameron would jump on a two-hour call sometimes and talk about the storyline and where it was going. Because, you know, we shot 600 hours of footage. And when you shoot that much, there's so many different stories you could tell of different people's backgrounds. And so we ended up with Patrick Baboumian, the strong man, or Scott Jurek, the runner, and you can really pull out different stories. And so James Cameron was extremely useful in that regard and understanding narrative and flow of a film. Obviously, having some of the highest grossing films of all time, James Cameron is a true expert in that field. Even though this was a documentary, it was still helpful in terms of the, you know, narrative structure of the film. And especially the favorite, everyone's favorite scene, which is the scene about erections. We thought, wow, it's a bit too risky. We probably shouldn't film that. And James Cameron said, no, that's going to, you know, you should, because that's going to get to the heart of the real men eat meat myth. And for those people that haven't seen the film, it's basically three collegiate athletes, one night eating a plant-based meal and the next night eating an animal-based meal and looking at the difference in blood flow to the penis. And there's FDA-approved devices that measures those erections. And so it was a bit of a comedic scene, but also pretty telling in terms of, you know, being masculine, people thinking, you know, you're going to be more masculine or whatever that actually, whatever that mean, that term really means, who knows. It shows that plants had a benefit there as well.
All the men, you got to go watch this documentary for your own good. So don't skip it.
Right.
So in the movie, again, you highlight athletes who adopted plant-based diets. What are some of the compelling stories of transformations that stood out to you?
I mean, I think across the board, mainly the fact that nearly all of those people, well, all of them, I think, all the athletes originally sort of thought they'd never be able to do it eating just plants. The one exception probably would be Nimai Delgado, the bodybuilder. Now, he wasn't vegan from birth, but he was vegetarian. So he'd always been able to do it without meat. But really, I don't think even he originally believed that you could do it without plants. And so just the sort of transformations of, not just the physical transformations, right, where some of them had significant benefits. You know, Patrick Baboumian, for example, did it for ethical reasons. Some people did it for health, for environment. But Patrick did it for ethical reasons. And he thought, and he was a strong man, and thought, okay, I care about the animals. I don't care if I got weaker, right? Because I care more. You know, I think he started because he saw a little baby bird on the road and he went to pick it up and rescued it. And then he went home and was going to eat a chicken. And he was like, this doesn't make any sense. This is incongruent and doesn't make sense logically. And he thought he would get weaker, but actually he got stronger. So that was a really interesting thing. But across the board, I think it's not just the physical, it's the sort of this belief system where you've been told by society one thing, right? And then people are realizing, hey, I can actually achieve all of the goals that I want, feeding plants and leaving animals off the plate.
Yeah. You know, obviously there's the physical health and there's ethics. What's your experience been on the mental health side of transitioning from meat to plant-based?
It's hard for me to say, like, you know, because you go through certain mental health issues and anxiety and stresses, and they vary over time. So it's hard, you know, to look at the objectively compare one day to a different day. But for me, I would say from a mental perspective, I generally feel better mentally about it, because once you realize that meat isn't normal, natural, or necessary, before that you have cognitive barriers, right? Accepting some of the perhaps ethical issues or environmental issues. But once you start trying it, and I didn't set out saying, okay, I'm going to be plant-based permanently. I just said, oh, I'll give it a try. And then you start realizing, oh, I can, you know, this meat isn't necessary, these eggs, this fish isn't necessary, I'm actually feeling better, then I think mentally you feel better about your actions, that you're doing something good for the planet, for yourself, and obviously it's better for the animals and all of those things. So I think from a mental perspective, I just feel better and I feel like I'm acting more in line with my values as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I mean, you're living a very conscious life, and myself being raw vegan for, 14 years now, not 100% anymore, 70%, but I have tons of energy, more than people would like, but it's a sense of calmness and clarity. And obviously, everyone experiences life as it goes, but abundant energy. So I still advocate for that. Out of curiosity, James, what was your training schedule when you were at the UFC?
Yeah, I mean, it goes up and down depending on how close to a fight. But obviously, on regular days, at least training twice a day, 5 or 6 days a week, and at least training 6 days a week, sometimes once only on the weekend. But things have changed a little bit more recently. So, back in the day, you would, having to do different sessions. You do a boxing session, you might do a kickboxing session at another gym, you might do a jiu-jitsu session at a gym. But as I was into it, it started to be more where these sort of these mixed martial arts schools where you're combining it all under one. But you'd typically still do at least a couple of sessions a day, sometimes strength and conditioning, sometimes jiu-jitsu, sometimes doing high intensity interval training, like running steps or, flipping tires, sledgehammer, that type of stuff. And then as I got close to the fight, personally, I'd always leave it too late to get the weight down. And so end up having to do 3-a-day sessions. So maybe get up at 5 a.m., go ride a bike for 2 hours, go back to sleep, get up at 10:30 a.m. and go train again. There's a few other things I would do. After training, I would sleep in a hyperbaric chamber, which helps drive oxygen recovery in. At night, I would sleep in a hypoxic tent, which simulates altitude, so you create more red blood cells. So there's the training part, but there's also the rest and recovery. And then I think I knew before that nutrition was important, but I'm now realizing, from both the health perspective, from a performance perspective, and from a recovery perspective, and also for a lot of people, weight loss, they're really digging into their exercise, but really nutrition is key. And so, training is part of it. And it was certainly, it's pretty abusive on the body, right? Because you're not only working out hard, but you're also getting hit a lot and your limbs cranked and that type of thing. But as I was getting older and wiser, I realized how important recovery was. And the biggest part of recovery, there's all factors like sleep and, not drinking alcohol, or not drinking much alcohol, not smoking and things like that. But nutrition really was a massive key.
Fascinating. Very intense. I was at an event over the weekend and someone said, is it important that I'm physically active or do I eat right? I mean, the real answer is both, but I said, I think it's important you eat right because you need to go for a walk. Yeah. So the billion-dollar question, which still is around, is protein. Where do you get your protein? And I know no one goes to a hospital for protein deficiency. So how do you explain the protein availability in a plant-based diet, especially for bodybuilders?
Yeah, so there's a few things unwrapping the protein question. One is amount, right? And the amount that you eat depends really on what your goals are. So if you're just if you're a bit sedentary, you're not working out much, you don't need as much protein. If you're trying to maximally build muscle, it seems like 1.5 to 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. Again, that's if you're trying to maximize. You can still build muscle with less than that, but trying to grow as fast as possible. The research seems pretty clear, around 1.5, 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight, which is about 0.7 0.7 grams of protein per pound of body weight. And you can get that from plants, right? Like the animals are just the middlemen. Now, to be fair, you do have to be a little bit more cognizant. If you're eating meat and eggs and fish and dairy every meal, then there's lots of protein in it. And a lot of plant foods do have a lot, have less protein. So you do have to be a bit more cognizant if your goal is being super athletic and building as much muscle as possible. I mean, I don't think most people, that's their goal, right? They'd like to lose a bit of fat sometimes, have a decent amount of muscle mass, be fit and healthy. So that's just, I'm just talking at the upper end. If you're in a caloric deficit, your protein requirements, in other words, you're losing weight, your protein requirements to build muscle do go up a little bit from there. But for most people, and you can get that, right, from beans, lentils, tofu, tempeh. Of course, a lot of athletes, 50% of amateur athletes and 80% of professional athletes already use a protein powder, right? So that's a simple switch. You can just go to a plant-based one. Or, people drink milk. Simple switch, just go to a plant-based milk. So protein is important. I think you do have to be a little bit more cognizant of it if you're trying to be athletic and build as much muscle as possible. Mm-hmm. But protein originates in plants. That's where the animals are getting it from, at least. Animals don't make protein. You can cut that middleman out and get it. Then you can get all of the benefits, like the fiber and so forth. And then the second part of the question is like the bioavailability. So these protein scores, there's the PDCAS, which is the protein-corrected digestibility amino acid score, and DS, which is the digestible indispensable amino acid score. They're very flawed systems. They were built for starving children in developing countries to make sure they're getting enough protein. And they're done mostly on rats and pigs, which have a different digestive system, different amino acid requirement. They test uncooked proteins, which doesn't make any sense. For example, you have to cook beans. Mm-hmm. Beans that come in a can are already cooked, of course. There's these things called trypsin inhibitors, and they inhibit the amount of protein. So if you test them uncooked, which is an unrealistic scenario, you get funny numbers, and those systems don't make sense. So people talk about protein quality. I think that we're looking at protein quality in the wrong way. People are looking at like which of how many amino acids does it have. I think you should be looking at the package, because generally you eat food. Mm-hmm. And so are you getting it with fiber and phytonutrients and antioxidants? Or are you getting it with saturated fat and cholesterol and advanced glycation end products and these cancer-causing potential compounds? So, and to me, so that's more important, is like what is coming with the protein that you're eating. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is, these studies have been done at 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight, maximizing muscle mass. Mm-hmm. And even the thesis of the film has been more reinforced since it came out. There's been more of these studies done, randomized controlled trials. It's the outcome that matters, not this sort of mechanistic speculation of like, oh, there's a bit more of this amino acid in whey protein. Like, it doesn't matter, because the outcome is that you can build just as much muscle, even completely consuming only plants.
Right. Fascinating. And I think coming from a science background, some of these trials and studies we do, we design them in order to get a specific outcome. We always get what we're looking for, right? So, I mean, that's kind of the misinformation we live in. James, clearly you're very well-read, too well-read that I was watching one of your videos that gave me a little bit of anxiety, because it was a very heated debate with Joe Rogan and Chris Kresser, where you were debating about the B12 and the cattle and the water and the dirt. B12 is important for the nervous system and healthy red blood cells. So the question is, to B12 or not to B12? And when should one be taking supplements?
Yeah, so definitely if you're eating completely, well, first of all, let's take a step back. 40% of people in the US are low in B12. The vast majority of that 40% is obviously, based on population statistics, is meat eaters. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and especially as you get older, right, you lose some of the intrinsic factor, which helps you absorb that B12. So there's two ways to look at it. One is an insurance policy. Should everyone be taking B12? Or two, you should at least be getting blood tests and seeing if you're B12. And by the way, the standard B12 tests are often can be thrown off by things like folic acid. So there's a test called methylmalonic acid, which will test a better B12 status. But yeah, you're either taking it as insurance policy, right, even if you're eating meat, or getting your levels checked. But if you are on a completely or heavily plant-based diet, then it is important to get B12, because you're not going to get sufficient numbers of that B12. Typically, you're not going to get that just from eating plants. And so either supplementing or taking or consuming products that have been fortified. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important. And there's, you know, you can either do that on a daily basis, or you can do it once a week. Funnily enough, you can't just times the daily basis by 7 to get the weekly, because of the way that it's absorbed. And I'm not a dietitian, right, or a certified health professional. So I don't want to give recommendations of exact amounts, but you can certainly look that up quite easily. But I don't want to, you know, I don't want to sort of go afoul of making any recommendations, but I personally do it once a week, and it's, you know, a higher dose. But that's my thought, is that B12 is important. Vitamin D is also an issue for a lot of people, whether they eat meat or not. It depends on where you live. And the funny thing is, people say, oh, well, if you have to supplement something, then it's not a good you know, diet, you would have been deficient in it. But the thing is that people on animal or omnivorous diets are supplementing just indirectly. Like, the cattle are fed B12 and all sorts of other supplements. One of the major sources of iodine in the American diet is the potassium iodide that's used to clean the teats of animals or the inside of milk tankers. So it's like, it's not even intentionally added, but it's a primary source of iodine in the American diet. Of course, salt was iodized, I think, in 1922 or 1923, because there was a worldwide iodine deficiency, which is why they added iodine to salt. But it is important to make sure you're getting iodine in from somewhere. But it's not a problem for just people on plant-based diets, right? These are issues for people on omnivorous diets, but certainly B12 is the one that people should take into consideration and speak to the healthcare practitioner.
What's interesting to me, and the question is, you know, when I look at the US diet regulations versus Europe versus other countries, most of the products that are banned in other countries are allowed in the US. Obviously, I have my own theories as to why that is, right? One is the farm subsidies that happened a long time back for wheat, corn, and soy. It's abundant, it's cheaper. So we have all these products, which is creating other issues, which is depression, obesity, cancer, whatnot. Where do you think things should change in that space?
Well, I think a lot of it is from a policy perspective, right? And obviously there's the vested interests of the funding. So the political system itself, and I'm not super into politics, but the political system itself seems to be in pretty bad shape where companies can really have such strong influence. So I think there needs to be a fix there. I mean, I think there's been some fixes at the level of like the Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee, for example, in the Food and Law Journal in 2010, they pointed out that there's only 9 members of the Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee that's coming up with every 5 years with the dietary guidelines. And they were getting paid from the Sugar Association, from the National Cattlemen's Association, and not declaring those. So I think the transparency is important. But then I also think from every time you buy something, you're voting with your dollar, right? And so the system will shift if people start eating differently. And so just, as a consumer trying to become more educated and then making those informed choices, because those foods are out there. So I think it's multifaceted from what the companies are doing to the politics and the influence there. And then also, at the consumer level, people making. And the good thing is that you have, an individual has power over their health to a large degree and can make purchasing decisions and they can get informed. So I think it's multifaceted.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Because I've done this for too long, some people think being a vegan or a plant-based or raw vegan is kind of a bougie, obviously living in Los Angeles, but they think it's for the privileged. And I agree for some part, right? If you're obviously talking about the superfoods and extra things, yes, there's a cost attached to it. But to just eat healthy, I don't think it's that expensive, right? Like eating bananas or drinking coconut water or eating, much more, even lentils and legumes. What are your thoughts on plant-based diet just for being the privileged?
It's not a black and white issue, I think. So first of all, there have been studies done where researchers have said, look, what if we built an American diet that had half as much meat as the standard American diet? And then what if it was completely plant-based? And they found on average, people would save $750 a year if they went completely plant-based over having the diet that had half as much meat. Mm-hmm. So it's obviously a myth that the expense of those foods, even if you go to a fast food joint, right, or if you go to Chipotle, you get the free guacamole if you get the plant-based vegetarian one, right? Whereas you'd have to pay a few dollars for the guacamole otherwise. And overall, you go to places, the tofu or the bean dishes or burritos or whatever it is are often cheaper, even at fast food. But if you go to the grocery store and you buy beans, lentils, whole grains, the staples, right, of your calories, you end up spending less. Now, the second part of that, though, is that there's sort of an informational issue, an educational issue, but two, access for food. I think, depending on where you live and if your income is poor, if the only place nearby and walking distance is the 7-Eleven or whatever, yeah, I think that we need to do a better job of getting access to people and then the educational piece as well. And then the subsidies, right? Like the true cost of if you go on gamechangersmovie.com, we've got a breakdown on there, but the true cost of a Big Mac would actually be $15 if you took into account the externalities and the true cost. So we subsidize the grain that we're feeding to animals below cost of production. Mm-hmm. And so you end up with an artificially low price for meat. So that's another thing, right? If we at least are subsidized in alignment with our own government recommendations, which are already a bit skewed, but we don't, we say eat more fruits and vegetables, yet we don't subsidize those anywhere near. It's over 1,000-fold we subsidize meat and dairy in terms of dollar amount. It's in the millions for fruits and vegetables, and it's in the billions for animal food. So that's a start as well, right? If you're making meat artificially cheap for consumers, they're more likely to eat that as well. So I think it's a bit of it's not a black and white issue. It's a little bit gray. And yeah, I think we need better access to food, better education, and more subsidies for healthier plant foods.
Absolutely. Many pieces to the puzzle. Beyond the benefits of getting healthy and fit with a plant-based diet, we face a climate crisis. How do you see a plant-based diet positively impacting our environment?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think it's the number one thing that anybody can do if you look at the data. So one of the biggest factors for the climate is the amount of land that we use. And it just takes an extraordinary amount of land to feed the animals. So like the food that is grown for animals, people talk about the Amazon rainforest down being cut down for soy and saying, oh, well, vegans eat soy. That's a bit of a misdirection because most of that, the vast majority of that soy is being fed to cows, right? And if we could free up that land, then we could rewild it. And if we rewild it, we draw down carbon. And it's really the number one thing that anybody can do for the environment. It takes 2,400 liters of water to make one hamburger. Right. So people are worried about like turning the faucet off at home when they're washing their hands for a little bit or having shorter showers. But your water usage isn't primarily coming from the direct use that you have at home. It's for the food that is grown that you're buying at the grocery store or the farmer's market or whatever. And so, yeah, we really need to, the more we shift to plant-based eating, the more land we free up and you know, less methane produced and so forth. I really think it's the number one thing that anyone can do above using less water, changing light bulbs, flying less. As an individual on a daily basis, we can make a decision to eat more plants.
Absolutely. Conscious living again and again. Mm. Phyta is a new plant-based protein mix, which you created.
Yeah.
What are the ingredients in it? And what is your vision for the future of the plant-based diets and sports nutrition?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't set out to create a brand originally, but we kept getting requests for, you know, clean, high protein. And again, you can do this all with whole foods, no doubt, whole plant foods. But sometimes people want that more convenient, you know, clean, easy way to get in protein, right? It's just easier sometimes and more convenient. And so people are looking for those types of ways to get it, especially, you know, for people that are very active or athletes. Mm-hmm. And people are saying, you know, which products meet the team's strict criteria for at the intersection of health and performance that also taste great and delicious, have good texture. And I really couldn't recommend hardly any. So I thought, well, we'll have to make it ourselves. And so, yeah, we've just launched a flagship product with Phyta. That's FYTA, which is derived from the Greek word for plants. We just launched our flagship product, which is this completely unique proprietary blend of upcycled barley protein, which is the world's most sustainable protein per life cycle analysis. Less water use, less land use, less pesticide use, less emissions than any other protein powder on the planet. And we combine that with whole ground lupin, so a whole food that's been ground down, which is high in antioxidants and fiber, and it's an ancient bean. So we combine those two things, creating a product which beat the two top leading protein brands 3-1 in consumer testing at the National Food Lab. And it's really the first time that there's a plant-based protein that has a better taste and texture than whey. Whey protein has had 50 or 60 years of development behind its taste and texture, especially the texture, right? The grittiness and chalkiness of the plant proteins has been an issue. And so we wanted to provide something that was not only as good as whey, but better in terms of taste and texture, obviously better for health, and obviously better for the environment as well. So we just launched that brand recently.
Yeah, fantastic. So where can people find it?
So right now, it's available for sale on the website. It's FYTA.com. Yeah, and maybe we could put a little discount code for any of your listeners if you're interested. Oh, yeah. But we can put that in the show notes or whatever. And then it's also just now available on Amazon as well.
Awesome. Everyone go check it out. I will put in the show notes the discount code so you can save the planet and also your health. So James, I hear you're gearing up for the next sequel for The Game Changer. Exciting. Mm-hmm. Without sharing much, what can you share?
Yeah, so it's still early stages. We're in pre-production at the moment, going into production soon. So it won't be out till 2025. This is looking more at sustainability and the planet and the future of the planet and also children's health as well. So it's shifting away really somewhat from the sort of athletic aspect. We already covered that. You know, people reaching out saying, hey, there's these great athletes. I'm like, well, we already kind of covered that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I really think the future of the planet is doomed if we don't make a big shift towards plant-based eating. And again, we're not trying to say you've got to go vegan or you've got to go vegetarian in order to help the planet. We say it's all or something, not all or nothing, right? So we're encouraging, like, hopefully people can go all the way, but, you know, just shifting more in the plant-based direction is going to be beneficial both for your health, mm-hmm. and also for the planet. And so the film will cover that. Yeah, we're in pre-production, so this, I couldn't even tell you the whole flow of the film yet anyway, but we're working with LeBron James as executive producer and his team at Spring Hill and Uninterrupted as a production team. So We're excited. And that's all being run through our nonprofit, the Game Changers Institute, which is a 501c3. Yeah, we're excited about that coming out.
Fantastic. Excited. Well, I'm going to put this in public. If you ever need an actress to help you with the movies, I'm right here.
Awesome. So,
the three takeaways for the future of health, James, what would it be for you?
That's a good question. Three takeaways for health. Well, number one, I think, is getting your nutrition dialed in, right? And again, for that, I suggest, again, we're not trying to tell people what they should be eating, but I think based on the evidence, having a either predominantly or exclusively plant-based diet. And again, when I talk about plant-based, mostly whole foods. So beans, lentils, peas, whole grains, fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds should really be the bulk of your diet, in my view. And then so that's number one, is getting your nutrition dialed in. Number two, I think people should be exercising, you know, almost every day, if not every day, doing something, right? There's clear health benefits, even though I believe in terms of fat loss, nutrition is a more important factor by quite a bit. In terms of health, exercise is also important, second after nutrition. And then I think the other thing is, for me, I mean, it's hard to stick it down to three because there's also like social connections and, you know, not smoking and not drinking too much. But I think the third one for me would be getting sleep. Maybe it's just because I'm getting older, it feels more important. But getting a good amount of sleep appropriate for your age. Obviously, when you're a kid, you know, if you're a kid, you need a lot more. As you're an adult, you need a bit less. But, you know, I like to try to get, if I can get 8 hours, then I feel good. I know some people can do less. But getting good sleep and trying to go to bed at a similar time every night, those are the three sort of staples. People make it, you know, can get complicated about what supplements they're taking or doing ice baths or saunas or whatever the latest thing is. I'm not saying there's not benefits to all of those things, but I think you've got to get the basics right, the fundamentals. So nutrition, exercise, sleep, to me, are the top three.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, James, thank you so much for your time. These were great, your insights. And again, I'll drop the discount code in the show notes, but check it out for FITA. But James, thank you so much for being part of Health Forward.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. This is Health Forward Podcast, and I'm your host, Smriti Kirbanandan.